Okay, so have you ever been in an argument with someone, and somewhere in the middle of that argument, you realize that the two of you are not actually talking about the same thing? Does that happen? Your nervous giggles tell me it has, right? This happens to couples a lot, right? No matter how long that they've been married. I'm going to give you a generic example that has happened in thousands of counselors and pastoral offices. The names have been changed to protect the innocent, right? Jerry and Diane, they've been married for a long time. They've got a rough patch, and so they come into the counselor's office, right? First question out of the gate from the counselor is, so what seems to be the problem? The question can't even hang in the air. Like if the counselor was writing out the sentence, she wouldn't have time to put a period underneath the question mark. When Diane just blurts out, our problem is intimacy, he can't be intimate. Jerry kind of tenses up in his chair. What are you talking about? I'm great at intimacy. You're the one with the problem of intimacy. What? There's no way that's the case. And all of a sudden, they start running down this well-worn path of argument. So the good and patient counselor says, okay, can we just take a break here for a second? I'm not sure I understand what each of you means by the word intimacy. Could you just tell each other what you think this word means? Noticeable pause now. Wheels are turning. And Jerry responds first. He says, well, I think that intimacy runs the full range of physical affection for each other. And I think I'm comfortable with that, right? And when he talks, Diane has this notable, like, eye roll. You know, she probably exaggerates it. Oh, my gosh, right? That's not what intimacy means at all. It means sharing our deepest emotions and feelings and thoughts in a safe, non-judgmental way. This is what they're talking about. Now, some of you at this point, your ribs may hurt a little bit because your spouse or partner is sitting next to you, elbowing you a little bit. Or maybe you want me to record these definitions of intimacy so you can go back home and play it back for someone. But this is a common way that we talk. Right? Couples are using the same word, but they're talking past each other, right? And the only way to have good communication is not always that we agree with each other, but we at least have shared meaning so that we're talking about the same thing at the same time. Now, here's what I find that's true of our reading here for today. We could spend a lot of time talking about things that Paul is not actually very concerned about. So it's important. All this talk of resurrection and bodies, and maybe you thought, what kind of church is this? That's not in the Bible. Here it is, but before we get too far down the road, let's understand what exactly is Paul talking about here? What's his meaning? So we're wrapping up this four-week journey through Paul's first letter to the church in Corinth. He wrote this letter when he heard about the dysfunction happening at a church that he had planted in southern Greece. They were fracturing over all these petty squabbles. I'm sure you've never heard about these in a church before. Here's a list of a couple of them. Which former preacher was best? Whose baptism or worship leadership was more meaningful? Which theologian was the standard bearer of the congregation's life and thought? The kinds of things they want to argue with each other about. And so the issue that Paul tackles most directly in chapter 15, before we got to our reading for today, is that there were some members of the church who began to deny that at the end of time, God recreates this new world of justice, love, and mercy, that there will be some form of resurrection of the dead so that all people across all time and all places can participate in a new age of peace and joy. And instead, they taught that resurrection was this beautiful metaphor. It was a metaphor about some exceptional quality of spiritual life, something akin to spiritual enlightenment that these, coincidentally, small group of church members were already experiencing. Right? And so they walked around telling people that they experienced the resurrection in every moment. You notice how my nose is just starting to get up in the air, right? This is how they behaved. And everybody else, all the people like you and me, we didn't have resurrection. We didn't have these best spiritual gifts, and we were just too lowly and earthly, and that really was the problem here. And for Paul, this is pretty terrible. Both Paul as the pastor and Paul as the theologian. First, he tackles it as a theologian. He says, look, the resurrection isn't just this one moment in time. It's not just this beautiful metaphor. It is God's culminating and yet unfinished work in history. For Paul, the resurrection of Jesus is the first and most important event in the final chapter of God's story of redemption, of reconciliation, and hope. On Easter, Paul believes God's life-giving power, it invaded the cosmos, it conquered death, and with this act, God declared certain victory over death. And so it's the heart of the gospel is a message that God's love always wins. That God's love is more powerful than death and violence, hatred and injustice. At the core of the gospel is a story of a God who refuses to abandon humanity to the powers of sin and death. That this is a God of life and love who is always active, always present in the world. And so our reading this morning, it continues this line of thought and these teachings that Paul is given to First Church Corinth. But remember, he's writing also as a pastor. Paul didn't wake up one morning and say, you know what, I'd like to write a letter to Corinth. I have so much book smarts and wisdom and theology to give them. I'm just going to write this long, complicated letter of theology and just give them this great gift, right? Now, Paul does believe that ideas matter, but what he believes more than that is that ideas have a way of shaping us. How we think about God shapes how we understand faith, and how we understand faith shapes the way we live our lives. So the purpose for Paul is bringing the Corinthians' thinking into proper shape so that it can influence their behavior. They can live in ways that resemble the life of Jesus. Because this new theology that had emerged in Corinth, it was actually very old. It was what everybody else around the world believed. All it did was reinforce class distinctions. All it did was reinforce social divisions. The Roman society was fractured and stratified, and Paul says this is not how the church should be. The church is supposed to be this place where we forget all of that. He writes in Galatians, for the community of followers of Jesus, church is a place where there is no longer Jew nor Greek, no longer slave nor free, no longer male nor female, for all of us are one community in the love of God. Paul wants us to see ourselves as part of a bigger story. A bigger story of God healing the brokenness of the world, a bigger story of God reconciling people who are once enemies, that they might be friends, a story of hope. He wants us to see the church as a community where resurrection is experienced as a force, as a power, as a movement in the world that makes lives change and communities get transformed because God is there. And so that's why I'm not going to spend much time this morning dissecting Paul's argument about resurrected bodies, right? And seeds and wheat and other grains and all that kinds of things, because that's not really at the heart of what Paul wants to talk about, right? Now, For those of you who are just very curious and you're dying to know what does Paul mean by resurrected bodies and all these things, you can come to Bible study on Wednesday and we'll talk more about that, because that group is very patient with me on my rabbit trails and things I draw on whiteboards. But for you this morning, let's not worry about that. Let's focus on what's most important, this shared meaning here, like that married couple I talked about in the beginning. And so what's most important, what Paul is talking about above everything else, what all this language is pointing back towards, is that Paul is proclaiming that the gospel of Christ's resurrection should enable us to live without fear. And it should empower us to live in the world as people who have been shaped by God's love, a love that always wins, right? So to give us hope and to shape how we live our lives. Now, this is a good word. This is something I think churches everywhere could learn from, right? About how we live our lives, not just about what we think. I mean, so oftentimes we think about faith as a body of ideas, not necessarily a way of life. For Paul, faith is a verb. It's an action. It's an activity. It's got to be lived. It's not simply just believing a set body of ideas. And this is something we're experiencing in the American church, right? We divide over all kinds of different issues of doctrine, who can and can't be parts, members of our church, and this is true of liberal and conservative churches, so no one gets to be safe from my criticism here. I mean, we make all these long lists about what you have to believe in order to be a Christian. You have to believe either that the Bible is the literal, inerrant word of God, or you have to believe that it's just a collection of spiritual reflections on God. You have to believe either that God created the universe in seven literal 24-hour periods, or that it's a symbolic story about God's relationship with humanity. You have to believe certain things and have firm statements about the doctrines of election, predestination, justification, the sacraments, creation, salvation, revelation, providence, the second coming of Jesus, and who the best baseball team is. Okay, that last one is not actually a doctrine of the church, but spring training is coming up. It is very important. I have my own answers, but they don't bode well in Washington, D.C. So, anyways, we could come up with lists and lists, right? This week, I was looking at different denominations and churches, and the list of number of doctrines spans from one central belief to 115, right? And I'm amazed at how few of the subjects that we Christians divide ourselves over are actually issues that Jesus spent a considerable amount of time on in his ministry, or issues that were the focus of the work of the writers and pastors of the New Testament, right? Things that they devoted a lot of time to. Now, don't get me wrong. I think that ideas matter. Don't leave from here. It's, Pastor Austin, Vienna Baptist, that guy does not care about theology and ideas. No, you can ask my wife, who just this morning told me she wanted me to stop talking about some obscure third century church controversy and why it applied today. I went to seminary. I can debate theology with people who've been dead for 5,000 years, right? This is all they do to us. Theology matters, right? Ideas matter. But if you are to say, what is the gospel? It is first and foremost a way of life. It is first and foremost a relationship. He uses faith to refer to our relationship to God and our relationship to others. Right? And so when you go back and you look at the teachings of Jesus, go back to the gospel, Sermon on the Mount, notice how practical some of these teachings are. Right? They're not like Jesus is teaching philosophy 201. Feed the hungry, clothe the naked, care for the sick, visit the prisoner, welcome the immigrant, forgive your enemies. This is the core teaching. I've just summarized four gospels for you right there of teaching. These are the core practices of the Christian faith. Now, to be fair, Jesus is assuming that you already know the unfolding story of God's redemption told in the Hebrew Bible. Okay? Jesus assumes that you already agree that we worship a God of justice, love, and mercy. And Paul does the same, and when he writes to people who are not of Jewish faith, he takes time to explain, this is who we believe God is. This is what we believe God does, and so this is how we should live our lives. Paul is not spending time here in chapter 15 trying to wrestle a dysfunctional church into agreeing with him on a very minor point of belief about resurrected bodies at the end of time. Right? Paper's limited, ink is limited in the ancient world. He wants to spend all that money on how plants grow. These are farmers. They know how plants grow. Paul wants the church to believe in a very simple creed of faith. That Christ has died, that Christ is risen, that Christ will come again. That's his theology. And that God has done all of this, not because of something we've earned, something we did, but simply because God loves us, because of God's grace and mercy. It is given to all freely, and because of that, we're all equal in this. I don't get to come to church on Sunday and tell you all that because I've got a couple of thick books on theology and prayed three times last week, I somehow have a better relationship to God and greater access to the divine than all of you. It's not how that works. I knocked something over this morning. I tell you, it wasn't a very Christian response I had when something broke, right? Working on it. Paul, in his writing, says, I'm working on this too. I haven't achieved. Paul, the writer of the majority of the New Testament, never tells us, I have arrived at true spirituality. I have mastered following Jesus. He's always saying, God, there's something I'm still working on. There's a failing I still have. I have yet to realize fully, and he's comfortable with that. And we begin to see all of us as equals, all of us as equally loved by God, equally given grace, then we stop trying to play this game as to who's better and who's worse, who's in, who's out, who's welcomed or unwelcomed, because if you follow the teachings of Jesus, go back to that parable of the Good Samaritan, right? Jesus says the goal of this is to love everyone, no exceptions. If you're worried about who has the right ideas and the wrong ideas, who's in or who's out, you're probably not following Jesus. Dismantled a lot here this morning, so we've got to build something up, right? You've got to leave with something. So, here's the good thing about all this. The good thing is that Paul has boiled this down to some pretty simple things, right? It actually comes from an ancient teaching by the rabbis. We would ask the ancient rabbis, can you tell us that we've got 600 some odd commandments in the Old Testament, we have all these stories about what God is doing in the world, how should we live our lives? And the ancient rabbis would say, all of the theology of our faith, all the commandments of the Bible can be boiled down to this: love God and love others. The rest is just commentary. Go and learn it. Jesus has something similar to say to us. It's simple, but it's not easy, right? The principle, forgive your enemies, is a simple one. It is not easy to live out. The disciples have trouble with this. Peter spends considerable time with Jesus trying to figure out what's the maximum number of forgiveness points he's got to give out before he can just stop, right? Jesus, if I forgive people seven times, is that good? I'm covered now, right? He says, no, Peter, not how it works. Just says, forgive your enemies. No limit. Disciples are always thinking, oh, here comes a person Jesus is not going to welcome. They're an outcast. They're a sinner. They're a Samaritan. Surely Jesus is going to throw them out because there's got to be some footnotes into this policy, and Jesus doesn't work for the insurance companies. So he just says, yep, you're welcome. I said all are welcome, and I meant it. For you this week, I want you to consider, what would your life look like? How would your theology change if you didn't look at the resurrection as a moment in time, but as a movement? As if God started something and we were invited to join in it. If we began to see resurrection as a calling to live out, if we practiced resurrection, if we lived resurrected lives, if we looked at our whole moments as, is this a moment right now for me to offer words of encouragement? Is this a moment for me to help someone? Is this a moment for me to feed someone who's hungry? I'll lose a couple bucks here, but this person is going to have dignity. Feed the hungry. Clothe the naked. Care for the sick. Visit the prisoner. Welcome the immigrant, forgive your enemies. The rest is just commentary. The rest is just beautiful reflections. We'll sing a hymn here in just a moment that I think is rather beautiful and a good summary of how we should live this week. I'm going to live so that God can use me. I live so that God can use me. Anytime, anywhere. Sing that. Maybe begin to sing that as a motto for this week. Right? As a way of approaching every day. As a mantra you might start a day with. Right? Today, I'm going to live so that God can use me. I'm going to look for every moment when I can practice the gospel, when I can live resurrection. And let's see what happens. The rest of all that stuff is for interesting teachings I can do on Wednesday and other times, right? But what changes the world, what changes our lives, what transforms our communities is when we put all this in practice. When we say that God is doing something, when we say that God is resurrected and we live like that. That's a faith that's inspiring. That's a faith that transforms us. That's a faith worth having. That's a resurrection. That's a movement, not a moment. So may you go from here, my friends, to live so that God can use you anytime and anywhere. Amen.